Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Tonight, we're doing a show. We're going to have a couple guests on the show. We're going to be speaking with Allison Moore, a young vice cop from Maui who became addicted to methamphetamine, the very drug she was working to get off the streets. Her new book is called Shards. A young vice cop investigates her darkest case of meth addiction, her own. She'll join us on the phone from Los Angeles a little later on. The book is intense.
Oh, really intense.
Really,
oh, my
really
goodness.
Intense.
A really interesting read.
Really interesting read. And you know, we talk a lot about first responders and addiction issues. And, you know, they have a different set of stressors and
a different set of access
and access as well. So yeah. we're going to be discussing that with Allison Moore. But first, we have to recognize the passing of one of the greatest comedians of our time. Robin Williams died last week at the age of 63. A fantastic actor. He was, you know, nominated for a few Academy Awards, and he won Best Supporting Actor for Good Will Hunting.
That was the, you know, the ability for him to get into those really, really sad people.
It was
beautiful.
He was an incredible actor. I had the opportunity to see him perform at a surprise show at the Comedy Connection about 7 years back, and I've never seen anything like that, and just to see that. But there's this intersection of mental health or mental illness and creativity that we like to talk about, but there's also the factor in the depression that Robin suffered from his whole life.
Well, and the addiction, which was part of his history, and he was so out with it and so open with it. And, you know, I mean, I remember various shows where he'd have like 73 glasses of water and trying to explain that it's not alcohol.
It's not alcohol. Well, to talk with us about that is our good friend Jimmy Tingle calling in. Jimmy's a Boston-based comedian, one of our favorite comedians. He's been a friend of Right Turns for a long time, and he did a really interesting interview or thing on WGBH that on the radio that we both thought was really great. So, Jimmy, welcome to Right Turn Radio again.
How are God's children today?
I don't know. We'll ask.
A little brighter for you being here, Jim.
You, Abby.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's you, Brother Woody.
No, this is John. This is John. The handsomer one.
Okay. Hey, John.
So,
how are you guys?
We're doing good, Jimmy.
We really liked what you had to say, and I liked what you said on, you know, the radio. But I just, how has it been for you, and what have you seen, and what do you've since Robin killed himself?
Well, obviously, I mean, nobody could believe it. It was such a devastating, I mean, it's terrible to hear anybody that you know die. And then to die at their own hands is incredibly, incredibly traumatic for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a sad, sad thing. And, you know, we were obviously devastated. I was not a personal friend of Robin's, but we have many mutual friends. Most of the comics in San Francisco, that's where he did most of his comedy, San Francisco and L.A., mm-hmm. when he was starting out back in the 80s. And, you know, we have many mutual acquaintances and friends. And they were, you know, obviously very devastated, as was his family. And it's just terrible. But here's the thing, and I tried to make this point, and what I love about what you're doing with Right Turn is you're reaching out to people and you're giving people permission to get help. And you're trying to explain to people that if people are suffering from substance abuse or whatever, mental illness or depression or whatever, it is never, now right now with the new health care legislation that has passed, it's never been easier, and help has never been more accessible to more people than it is now.
Right.
So if people have the willingness, if they have the willingness to pick up the phone and call, you know, whether it's a substance abuse facility, whether it's the local 12-step programs, whether it's the local hospital, you can call places and you can get help. The only ingredient that you absolutely have to have is willingness. And even And if you have that and you stick with it, you can get better. And there's there's help out there available. And that's what I love about what you're doing with Right Turn. And the point I was trying to make about Robin, for every person that's famous or well-known or in the movies, or for every star on Hollywood Boulevard that suffers from substance abuse or depression, there's millions of people who suffer in relative obscurity, and they don't have to. And they don't have to, and then they're not famous, and they never will be famous, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that you're important to your own family, your own community, your own network of people, your own, and wherever you're employed, or maybe you're the employer or the employee, you're important, and everybody's life matters, and that's the takeaway. If there's anything that comes out of it that's positive, it's that there's a heightened sense of awareness about the human condition and depression and substance abuse and the mental illness that many, many people are challenged by.
Well, I was really impressed by how many people you saw it as a good way to talk about this. So few people, there were some notable ones, but so few people spoke about, you know, how selfish this is or anything like that. Because I think they somehow, by watching him over the years, they saw the pain in him. And they knew he had everything. And if even he wasn't able to manage, then maybe it wasn't a bad, you know, maybe it wasn't a mean thing to do your family. Maybe it was just that the person was in too much pain.
Well, I would say sick rather than pain myself. I think there's an illness there, and I don't want to justify or judge or whatever. I'm just saying that he was obviously very sick, and sick people do things that we can't really explain.
Right.
You know, and so, and that's what we're trying to, I know that's what Right Turn is trying to do. You're trying to address people, and you're trying to address the illness of addiction. Because when we look at it as an illness, we're not looking at people that are bad,
right,
doing bad things, but we're looking at sick people.
Right, that's right. And there's a stigmatization of mental illness in this country and everywhere in the world. And we know, Jimmy, that a lot of addiction comes out of the theory of self-medication. In other words, and Robin talked about it too, you know, in his lifetime, is that people medicate mental illness. They medicate depression. They medicate anxiety. And there's the shame and guilt about coming forward and getting real treatment for it, whether that's, you know, just to address it, even among your family, seems difficult for a lot of people. So the fact that, you know, and I'm reminded of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, is that it's opening up this conversation, and it's opening up, you know, people who normally don't deal with this stuff to begin to talk about depression in America, talk about mental health and substance abuse, and that normalizes it, and maybe we'll be able to, you know, have it as a conversation and take it out of, you know, out of the jails and all that, and begin to treat people better.
I agree 100%, and you're right that one of the consequences of these high profile cases, it does start the conversation, and that's you know, that's a positive development out of it. But it's got to be more a part of our normal way of thinking about things.
Absolutely.
If you have, you know, whatever kind of disease a person is affected with, you know, whether it's if you have kidney failure or pancreatic cancer or epilepsy, whatever else, you get treatment for it to the extent possible. And it's the same thing with mental health issues, depression, and substance abuse. It's just another thing that we fortunately live in a country that we have the technology, we have the expertise, and we have the ability to treat people. And so that's a huge, huge step forward in the addressing this issue.
Well, thank you for your thoughts on this, Jimmy. What can we look forward for you in the future? What are you working on these days?
Well, I'll probably go to the moon soon.
Really?
I'll engage in some space travel. I don't know. I'm just going to keep working and writing, and I have to tell you, I watched Robin Williams the other night on Charlie Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I've been a comic over 30 years and writer, and I watched him on Charlie Rose the other night, and Charlie Rose had sat down with him many times over the last 25, 30 years, and right at his table on PBS, and he just had highlights of all the shows and all the conversations that he had with Robin Williams. And he was always interviewing him about something. Robin never went there to do a, quote, performance. But
right.
If you ever saw him in an interview, that's what he did. He would sit down, he would answer the question seriously, and then he'd go off into character. And he had Charlie Rose just laughing and laughing. And it was so beautiful because Robin's doing his bits, and he's hilarious. And then he'd come back and talk seriously about his comedy or his stand-up or process of it. Or, you know, whatever, you know, substance abuse or whatever it was.
We're gonna miss that about him, Jimmy, and we got to go to commercial, but I really appreciate you taking the time out and talking about Robin. I wanted to mention a couple numbers for people in if they're depressed, if they're thinking about taking their lives. Samaritans is a great resource for folks. The Samaritans statewide helpline number is 877-870-4673. And, of course, the Veterans Crisis Line for the men and women who have been of service to this country, 800-273-8255.
And we will post them.
We're going to post them on Right Turn's Facebook page. Tonight, we're going to be talking with Allison Moore, who's a former narcotics officer from the Maui Police Department. She worked vice there. She's a native of New Mexico, and she served a one-year sentence in federal detention center in Honolulu for drug-related felonies. She's going to tell us how she went from star of her recruited class in the Maui Police Department to her journey through the world of vice, and then with the methamphetamine addiction, and then her fall and her coming back after that. Allison Moore, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Abby and I both...
Whoa, what a book.
It must have been a painful book at times for you to write.
You know, it was painful, and I was actually, during the writing of the book, I was kind of angry, like, in the sense that, you know, if we're going to talk about addiction, let's really talk about it. You know, I decided I wasn't going to leave anything out, you know, regardless of, you know, what kind of outcome it might have, mm-hmm. and I just really wanted to tell it like it is. You know, I love that we're, you know, that you have your radio station. I mean, that's so great in itself. And I love that America's talking about addiction, but I mean, let's really get into it. You know, let's help people understand.
You mean that it's not all glamour and right. fancy cars?
Right.
I'm interested to know, how the idea to write a book after this incredibly traumatic experience journey that you had. What was the impetus for you to write the book?
Well, it's actually kind of funny how it came about. I'm really close with one of my aunts, and she went to college with Nancy Woodruff, my co-writer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was on pretrial, my aunt was reaching out to her friends. My family was so devastated when the truth about all my lies and my addiction came to the forefront. And Nancy had kind of been there from the beginning in terms of, you know, walking my aunt through her grieving process and then hearing about me and what I was going through third party at the same time. And Nancy is a well-known writer. So when I was on pretrial, Nancy approached me about the book. It was a terrifying idea for me. The last thing I wanted to do was talk about anything. You know, I just was white-knuckling it, just trying to wrap my brain around how I had gotten to where I was in my life and, you know, all the things that I had done. And Nancy was insistent that this could really help people, you know, and that although my story is gritty and raw, that there are other people in similar situations that could maybe take things from the telling of my story that may help them. And right. That's really what convinced me to go ahead with the book.
So let's just give a little background to the audience who's listening. You're, you know, a young lady from New Mexico, Albuquerque. You move to Hawaii, and you decide to become a recruit. You know, you test into the police department, and you become kind of a star recruit. Isn't that true?
Yeah. In a sense, you know, I would say my first really definable addiction was workaholism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know if I was such a star recruit as more than willing to sacrifice and work as hard as I could.
So you're there, you're getting set up, and in the book you talk about, I think it was the first time you did ICE.
Right.
On page 80, and could you set that this excerpt up a little bit?
Sure. This is the first time I tried ICE. It came to me in a roundabout way. I was an isolated user. I still have trouble kind of explaining to people why I tried it, other than I was just running. Workaholism wasn't working anymore, and with the series of events that had happened in my life, I turned to this drug in particular.
Yeah, you were really, really sad. It sounded, I mean, just the feeling was that things just weren't feeling good.
Exactly. You know, and the access to meth for me was there. If it had been heroin or cocaine or any other kind of narcotic, I would have used it. It was just a desperate plea to make the feelings that I was feeling go away, like all of us addicts, you know,
mm-hmm.
just that ultimate kind of numbing after workaholism wasn't working anymore.
So here's Allison Moore reading an excerpt from her book Shards on Right Turn Radio.
But then the pain subsided and the feeling of meth, the best feeling in the world, began to sit in. I could taste the meth running down the back of my throat, a taste similar to that of metal, bitter, strong, almost sour, but not quite. My jaw muscles clenched. My eyes were still watering, and I felt each tear run down my cheek, but the tears had changed. The release of the water from my eyes was the best sensation of crying I had ever felt. A wave of enlightenment came over me, a feeling that was all right with the world. A caffeine rush without the jitters, drunkenness without losing control, your first love without the heartbreak. Suddenly I could feel the hairs growing on top of my head. I didn't have 5 senses, I had 30. My thoughts began racing. What do I want to do first? Work, clean, go running, wash my car, go to the beach? There's so many possibilities. I can bake something for Chiave, do laundry. No. I can do anything I want to do. I have 3 days off. I can take an extra shift at work. No, I can't go to work high. Should I go shopping? No, don't leave the apartment. This is incredible. I should call my mom, sister, Mimi. I should call Chiave, Dina, Slim. No, don't do that. Clean. That is what I want to do. I want to clean and organize my entire apartment. Yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
That was such a perfect description.
and you know, we see people who come in, you know, meth addicts that come in, and we're really asking them to give up a lot. This is the great, you know, by all accounts, the greatest feeling
in
the world.
No, they never find it again.
They never get that first one back. But that, you know, so it's this incredible. And for somebody who is, it sounds like you were a pretty high achiever in life, or that was your kind of your mask. it sounds like it was the perfect drug for you to kind of latch on to.
Unfortunately, it was. It for me and my personality, my addictions, my void, mess just seemed to fill the void in the worst way.
We're talking to author Allison Moore about her new book, Shards. Allison was a young vice cop in Maui who became addicted to meth, the very drug she was working to get off the streets. The book is scary. It's eye-opening. It describes kind of perfectly the descent into active addiction.
Well, so she just, Allison, you just read this beautiful part about how it was meeting every single one of your needs. You had 30 senses. And then what happened describes a little of the plummet, because it was pretty fast.
The plummet was extremely fast. You know, I think John mentioned that your first hit is just that. The first hit, nothing's ever going to compare to that. For me, despite my extreme efforts, and I took extreme efforts to hide my addiction, it took me down pretty hard and fast. And, you know, there's a part of me that's pretty grateful for that. You know, there are people that live for decades and years fighting addiction. And I was lucky enough to go down and pretty fast.
But while you're going down, you are an active
cop.
Police officer in Maui.
Yes.
How are you able to balance these two things?
Not very successfully. You know, my workaholism came into play, and because meth is an amphetamine that kind of fit in with the nature of workaholism. You know, I didn't sleep. I thought that I could work harder, longer, faster, harder. And of course, as we all know, that's a fallacy, you know. So I took extreme measures to hide my addiction in order to balance the two. You know, I wore color contacts to hide the size of my pupils. I took weight gainers. And ultimately, I lied and lied and lied and ultimately hurt not just the people I love, not just my brothers in the department, an entire community, really.
Now, you brought up the lies, and I thought you described them really well in your book. Could you read a part where you're talking about that?
Sure. This is from page 127. It was going to take a big lie to buy me a little more time. One morning, Sergeant Wilkes called me into his office and said, "Moore, you look so thin. You look like you're dying. Do you have cancer?" That was just his way of joking. But a new lie had presented itself, a ready-made lie invented by someone else. "Yes," I said, "I do have cancer. That's why I'm so thin." "How long have you known?" "Since November." Wilkes nodded thoughtfully. "And when were you going to tell us?" he asked. "I honestly didn't think you needed to know," I said. "I know I can beat this thing. I don't want everybody feeling sorry for me. You know, there's not a man in this department who wouldn't be there for you if you needed us," he said. "I know, and I'll ask for help if I need it. But for now, I'm okay. I just don't want anybody to know. Please don't tell anybody." "You don't have to do this on your own," he said. "We're your brothers in blue." "I know." "What kind of cancer is it?" He searched for the word prognosis. "Ovarian," I said. "The prognosis isn't great long term, but I'm doing fine now." "Where did I get this stuff? Things I had read, I guess, or heard on TV?" I sounded utterly convincing. "Understand that at this point, I would have done anything to keep my addiction alive. Anything." Wilkes just happened to be there, and the comment that slipped out of his mouth became my new best lie. If it hadn't been Wilkes, it would have been another colleague, another lie.
Yeah, that...
That was summed it up.
That's, you know, so there's the, you know, we understand because we're in the field, I think, about how this kind of thing happens, but there's listeners that are wondering how, you know, and you sound like
a reasonable human being.
What is it about methamphetamine that could turn this person, this kind of high functioning
soccer star
police officer, and what is it about methamphetamine that makes you lose everything like that and will allow that kind of behavior to happen?
Well, you know, for me personally, meth just gave me the feeling of being invincible, you know, and it became everything to me, you know, and it affected me and my personality, you know, kind of being like a, you know, a type A kind of person in a way that I thought was amazing, you know, and for me it was just the most deadly drug ever. You know, it's hard to explain the want or the need for that drug that my body desires. You know, the chemical reaction in my brain was just the perfect storm, and there wasn't anything I wouldn't do for it. And ultimately, I did most everything. You know, people say, you know, you do that list of what you haven't done yet. Well, I don't have a lot of yets left on that list, you know, because the drug was just so desirable to me.
I'm wondering what, as a first responder and in the Maui Police Department, was there a culture that... if somebody did have a substance abuse problem, would it have been easy, had you not been kind of hijacked by the substance, would it have been easy for you to step forward? Had you seen other officers step forward and say, I have a problem, I need help? Or was that kind of not talked about?
You know, it's strange in first responders. I know first responders all over the country, and, you know, Maui included, have worked hard to allow for an open door policy and really to reach out and help their officers. But there's still this stigma that, you know, once you do that, you're tarnished, you're weak, you definitely will lose your badge. You know, there's just so much fear that goes behind any kind of sign of weakness or dependency on anything but yourself. And it's really sad and unnecessary. It's completely unnecessary. And for me, quite frankly, meth was so uncontrollably strong for me in the worst way that even if I had the best open doors, I probably wouldn't have taken them.
Well, that whole thing about the lie, you know, I'm not, all the things you said was just about, you could have said that about your addiction. I'm handling it. I don't need to share this with anybody. You know, the stuff you told your supervisor. So, I mean, so it's, and did other people in the department get caught while you were, I mean, you wrote about one or two. What was kind of the, what did people say about them when they got caught?
You know, it was, first it was such a, one gentleman did get caught during a random drug test. And what the guys kind of said, and we didn't say much because it was such a, you know, just an issue that we didn't talk about. And there was a little bit of talk about disappointment and how could he do this to the department, but that was about it, you know. And he was there one day and gone the next. So it was pretty cold and pretty sad.
So it was a pretty brave move writing this, telling this story. It's, you know, the strength kind of the inner strength that carried you through. We're going to, in the next segment, we're going to address some of the horrible trauma that you experienced,
but also the recovery.
The recovery, which is the important part of this, and the hope. But just, you know, the strength that it takes somebody to live through that.
And then write about it,
you know, is pretty evident. And also, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about just, you know, your life growing up and the idea that even though you came from addiction, it was never addressed in the family, and how that happens and sometimes helps people get sicker and sicker before they get any help. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be back right after the break.
One of the things and we're not going to ask you in great detail, but you went through incredible trauma and abuse and just horrible, horrible abuse at the hands of your quote-unquote dealer in Seattle. And you finally, between your mom and finding your cell phone, were able to get away. But one of the things that happened is you were traumatized and you didn't even know it. And can you kind of explain how that affected your first try at recovery and how you kind of started dealing with it?
Yes. Yeah,
you know, I know. Let's just go through really heavy things all at once. Yes.
So it's a great question, because I'm sure this happens to a lot of people.
Especially women.
Right. In recovery, I had, you know, finally gotten to the stage where I'd gotten most of the chemicals out of my system physically. Of course, the effects are in your brain for quite a while, but I had started having flashbacks of my dealer's house, and I thought I was going crazy. You know, I thought that I had fried my brain. You know, I thought so many different things. I didn't know what it was, and of course, I had heard about PTSD, you know, from war combat veterans and things like that, but I didn't ever associate it with any kind of experience that I had had.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very difficult time during recovery, and you know, it just sets in this sense of hopelessness.
Well, you would see him, you'd think he was there, you'd think, you were convinced he was there, and you were, that must have been really scary.
It was, and you know, I got really confused about what was reality and what wasn't, because my flashbacks are so vivid and so convincing, you know. So it was a very difficult time, and luckily I had an amazing counselor, and we were able to figure out what was going on.
What works for you to address the trauma? What tools have you gotten?
You know, it's been a long process. Just like recovery, you know, textbook is kind of addiction's kind of textbook, but the recovery for everyone is different.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what's been the most successful is EMDR, and what it is, in short, it's basically a rapid eye movement, and it's a condensed version of, you know, reliving those traumas, and the connection between the brain and the eyes is, the theory is, it's supposed to kind of diffuse the impact that those flashbacks have. For me, it doesn't change the frequency or anything like that, but it gives me a way to handle them without, you know, being completely floored or paralyzed.
It puts them in a different part of your brain, from what I understand.
Yeah, but that was a really nice explanation.
Yeah.
So,
what's the impact of the book been? Have you spoken to other first responders,
other trauma survivors?
How has this been received?
You know, it's been amazing. It's been a blessing. I was so terrified when the book was going to be released. Just about everything, you know, everything that surrounded the book, just being so public about all these wrongs that I had committed and how many people I had hurt, you know, everything. But it really opened the door for me to meet some amazing first responders, amazing people. I, like a lot of addicts and a lot of people with PTSD, I'm not big on crowds.
Mm.
So I'm big on forums and kind of, you know, finding the right forums for me and reaching out in that way. You know, so it's really been an incredible gateway for me to kind of reach out to the recovery community.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, in turn, they've just given so much to me. It's been amazing, amazing.
So have you been able to start mending any of the relationships?
No, I haven't. You know, making amends is such a big part of recovery.
Ooh.
And,
ooh,
you know, it's like, it's really difficult. I've reached out and, you know, there are a lot of people who aren't ready yet, and I completely respect that.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, so I, you know, making amends is my ultimate goal. And with this book, that is definitely one of my attempts, you know, to make amends to all the people that I've hurt.
Can you tell us about Catch a Falling Star, Allison?
Because some of your proceeds are going to that, right?
Right. A portion of the proceeds are going to Catch a Falling Star, which is an amazing charity. It's founded by Cindy Goss. And what they do is essentially a gateway for first responders and their families to find help for anything that they're suffering from. You know, that's anything from addiction to PTSD to anger issues. You know, if your family needs help with interventions, Catch a Falling Star really helps guide you. They also do amazing training and seminars for law enforcement and their families. It's just a great, discreet way for law enforcement to kind of find their way to the particular help that they need.
So
it's something I feel really strongly about.
That's a wonderful kind of beginning of an amends right there, Allison Moore. Thank you so much for being on Right Turn Radio. Allison Moore's new book is called Shards. A young vice cop investigates her darkest case of meth addiction, her own. Thank you so much, Allison, for being on Right Turn Radio.
And thanks for sharing
your
story. I think, you know, I want everybody to read it, because what you can actually see is people that it can happen to anybody.
That's right.
So thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Allison. Great show, Abby.
That was an intense book.
Yeah, yeah. And we've, you know, but this is a story that needs to be told. We see first responders at Right Turn, and they do have a particular, you know, even just seeking treatment if they have a problem. Sometimes it's getting better. We know people in the field that are helping, but it's still a difficult culture to be in if you're suffering from some of that stuff.
Right. And it's not that uncommon.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.